couple of years ago, my parents attended the funeral of a Jehovah's Witness lady. Now, I wasn't there myself, so I hesitate to speak authoritatively about what a Jehovah's Witness's service is like. But at least according to my parents, they said that on first impressions, well, most outsiders wouldn't think there was really much of a difference between a Jehovah's Witness Kingdom Hall and a little evangelical church like ourselves. Really, on first impressions, the people looked very much the same. They dressed and spoke very much the same. They were friendly. They sang songs. I hesitate to call them hymns, but songs. They had a Bible talk. Now, I wonder when you hear that, if that's true, I wonder, do you find that a little bit disconcerting? Are we all that different? That's the question you might find yourself asking. I mean, yes, we disagree, don't we, on certain doctrines. Yes, we believe that Jesus was the incarnate God. They think he's the Archangel Michael, but what does that really matter? I mean, we agree on so much else, don't we? And more than that, you might find yourself also asking, is the Bible really clear about Jesus being the incarnate God in the first place? I mean, yes, the Bible calls him the Son of God, and in response to that, the Jehovah's Witnesses would agree. But that's not the same as being God the Son, is it? Now, about a year ago, I started a series of midweek Bible studies, and we were looking at that title in the Bible, Son of God. And the Jehovah's Witnesses would point out, just as we did in those studies, that Jesus isn't the only one in the Bible who's called that. As we said at the time, Adam is described as a son of God. Israel is described as a son of God. David is described as a son of God. In the book of Genesis and in the book of Job, even the angels are described as sons of God. And I suppose that leaves us with a question, doesn't it? I mean, if even angels and human beings can take that title, Son of God, well then why must it mean anything very special when it comes to Jesus? Why must it be now a mark about his divinity? Is the Bible really that clear about Jesus being not just the Son of God, but rather God the Son? And if the Bible is not all that clear about this, then who are we to reject the Jehovah's Witnesses from the Christian Church? That's rather ungracious of us, isn't it? I wonder if you've ever had that thought this evening. And I wonder how we should respond then to thoughts like that. Well, this evening I do want to respond to those thoughts. And there are many ways in which we could do that. So that means I have to be a bit more focused in what I say this evening. And for that reason then, I'm going to focus our thoughts upon one particular place in the Bible, and that's the Gospel of John. Because more than in any other book of the Bible, in the Gospel of John, Jesus is referred to as the Son of God. But you see, I want to begin with a very important assertion. When Jesus, or rather when John uses that title of Jesus, Son of God, when he describes him in that way, he does it in such a way as to make it very clear he is setting Jesus apart from every and any created being, whether that be a man, or a king, or an angel, or an archangel. Yes, Adam and David and others in the Old Testament are described as sons of God, but it's imperative that we see Jesus is the Son of God in a way which is entirely, qualitatively, distinct and superior to all the rest. There is a divine sonship which he enjoys, which none of the other characters could ever enjoy. And in order for us to see that then this evening and the importance of this, I'm going to break my sermon up into two headings, or two questions really, and let me begin then by raising and answering the first of those questions, and it's this. What makes Jesus a unique Son of God? What makes Jesus a unique Son of God? I use the word unique, but in John's Gospel, John also uses a special word to describe the kind of sonship that Jesus has. And it's a word which I think he is deliberately choosing in order to draw a strong black line, to get out his felt-tip pen and draw that strong black line around the sonship of Jesus. It's a word which he uses to put Jesus in that entirely different category. And in the Greek, the word he uses is monogamous. Jesus is described again and again as the monogamous Son of God. Now, how do we translate that word? Well, older Bible versions tend to translate it with two English words, only begotten. The more modern Bible versions tend to translate it with just one word, only. Jesus is the only Son of God. But however you choose to translate it doesn't really matter for my purposes. You can't escape from the fact that this is John's way of saying Jesus is utterly, utterly, utterly unique. He is the only one who belongs to this particular category. John chapter 1 verse 14, we read it earlier. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we have seen his glory, glory as of the only Son, or the unique Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. John 3 verse 16, for God so loved the world that he gave his only, his unique Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish but have eternal life. John chapter 3 verse 18, whoever believes in him is not condemned, but whoever does not believe in him is condemned already, because he has not believed in the name of the only, the unique Son of God. John also uses the word in his letter. 1 John chapter 4 verse 9, in this the love of God was made manifest among us, that God sent his only, his unique Son into the world that we might live through him. So you see the point, in whatever way that Jesus is the Son of God, it is a way which for John applies only to him. It's not a broad category which all of these others can enjoy. No, there is a special sense, there's a unique sense in which Jesus is the Son of God. Not just that he is the Son of God in a greater kind of way, but there's something totally unique about it. There's an exclusivity to his position as the Son of God. So we come back to the question which I'm asking. How come? In what way? In what way is Jesus unique? In what way is he the only exclusive Son of God? Well, the first thing we might want to do in answering that question is to think a bit about how this metaphor of sonship works generally. How does that idea work in the ancient mind? To say that you're a son of something or a son of someone, what did that mean exactly for the ancient person? Well, in general, I think it meant that you possessed and expressed the same qualities as the thing of which you were the son of. So, James, the son of Alpheus. To be the son of Alpheus was to carry on Alpheus's reputation and Alpheus's legacy. It was to represent Alpheus as his son, but more than that, it was to possess Alpheus's nature. It was to have Alpheus in your DNA. Now, the idea of sonship, it's also applied metaphorically, isn't it? So, for instance, Jesus will say of James and John that they are sons of thunder. And what he's saying there is that they have all the characteristics of thunder. They're loud and bold and bombastic, and they come out of nowhere and they give you a fright. That's what he's saying of them. He's saying it with a twinkle in his eye. But by the very same logic, you see, to be a son of God is to share in the very same quality as God. Now, as we've said already, this metaphor, Son of God, doesn't just apply to Jesus, because in their own kind of way, men like Adam and Israel and David, they're all shared in the quality of their God. So Adam possessed and expressed the image of God. He imaged God. He represented his Father before the eyes of the world. Israel is described as God's son. And again, this is because ideally, he is to possess and express God's holy character as God's chosen nation before the eyes of all those dark, depraved nations around them. David is described as God's son because he is to powerfully possess and express his God and his God's just rule. He's imposing upon the world the rule of God. He's representing his God in that way. So you see, all of those characters then, as God's sons, they possess and express something of God himself. And that's true of us, isn't it? The Bible describes all of us, men and women, as God's sons, God's children. That's what it said at the beginning of John. He gave us the right to become children of God. And again, that means then that we possess and express something of God's characteristics now. Remember how Jesus says, blessed are the peacemakers because they will be called sons of God. He's saying to be a peacemaker, to be an ironic, relaxed, peaceable kind of person who's wanting to build bridges and resist conflict, that is to share in the quality of God himself, the God of peace. So in the ancient mind, to say that someone is a son of God simply means that they possess and they express the qualities of God. And that is a colossal and wonderful thing which each of us share in. But you see, that means then that when we now come unto Jesus, and when we come unto this only Son of God, this unique Son of God, this exclusive Son of God, what we now have to do is to take this very same principle and apply it to him in a way which is entirely unique. And that means then that he has to possess and express God in a way that all of the others simply could not. Not just in a way which is quantitatively different, but in a way which is qualitatively different. In a way that means that he and nobody else is able to say, there in John chapter 14, whoever has seen me has seen the Father. And really, I think we're forced to say this, aren't we? We're forced to say that when we talk about Jesus, we're talking about someone who not only possesses the character of God, we're talking about the one in whom, the Apostle Paul says to the Colossians, all the fullness of God is pleased to dwell. Paul is saying in a clumsy kind of way, all of the everything of God is pleased to dwell in this man. In the language of Hebrews chapter 1, we have something even more dramatic. Long ago, at many times and in many ways, God spoke to our fathers by the prophets, but in these last days, he has spoken to us by the Son, in whom he appointed heir of all things, through whom also he created the world. He is the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of his nature. So, other sons of God, that they share in the qualities of their father. They have something of his attributes, something of his moral character, and they represent him to some degree. But as for the only Son, he is the radiance of the glory of God, no less. He possesses his nature exactly, Hebrews says. Now, a moment ago I listed some of those places where John describes Jesus as the only Son. If you notice, in all of those verses, that's not just a title which Jesus has been given. It's not just a status which he occupies and which has been bestowed upon him. No, it's referring to something about him which is timeless. It's referring to an eternal relationship with the Father from before the world began. He is the Son. That is just who he is. It's not that he's become a son. It's not that he's occupied the status of a son like we do. He is set apart as the Son. Now, of course, in John's Gospel, that's something that we see from the very, very beginning, isn't it? You can turn it back, if you like, briefly now to the beginning of John's Gospel, if you want to, you don't have to. Where John says, this Jesus is the Word. The very first verse, he is the Word. That's his way of saying that Jesus is the flawless self-expression of God himself, uniquely connected to his very being. He is the Word which created the universe itself, verse 3. He is the source of all light and life in the universe. And he is a Word who both is with God and is God. So when we said before that to be the Son of God is different from being God the Son, not in the case of Jesus. Not in the case of Jesus. No, for Jesus to be the Son of God is for Jesus to be God the Son. Absolutely. Just look down there if you have John chapter 1 open. There at verse 18, the final verse we read. John uses that word only or unique again. It's not the easiest verse to translate. No one has ever seen God, the ESV has it. The only, but then John says, the only or unique God, or perhaps something like the only one or unique one who is God, who is at the Father's side, he has made him known. It can't be any more plain, can it? And after reading this book of John, then, we should have no more reservations about saying that this Jesus is indeed the incarnate God himself, God the Son in human form. Now, this isn't an idea, of course, which is unique to John. Of course not. Even that language of being the Son of God, it's not unique to John. You get it in the other Gospels. So in Matthew and Luke, for instance, Jesus says there, no one knows the Father except the Son, and anyone to whom the Son chooses to reveal him. Powerful language. The Son, that's in Matthew and Luke. But it's definitely something that John's Gospel brings much more to the surface. And if we had time this evening, we could go to various places. We could go to John 5 or John 8 or John 10 or John 17, so many other places to see this. We could even go to those seven famous occasions where Jesus says, I am a particular thing. I am the bread of life. I am the light of the world. You know, those statements which don't just tell us about Jesus' character in general. No, they're statements which tell us about his divine nature in particular. I am the bread of life. Jesus is the divine manna which comes from heaven. I am the divine means of your survival, he's saying. I am the only basis of your spiritual existence, he's saying. I am the light of the world. It's a divine statement, isn't it? I am the divine light which shines in the darkness, the one who illuminates the universe and brings life into existence. Before Abraham was, I am. I am the eternal one who precedes the beginning of this nation. I haven't just come out of this nation. I am before and behind this nation. I am the one who bears the divine name. The I am, Yahweh himself. I am the good shepherd. Psalm 23 says, the Lord is my shepherd. And Jesus is saying, I am that Lord. And of course we could go on, couldn't we? I am the resurrection and the life. I am the way, the truth and the life. I am the true vine. And with every one of those statements, it's another blow of the hammer, isn't it? The Son of God is unique. And what makes him unique? Well, he truly is the incarnate God. Jesus is God. I've mentioned all of those previous sons of God a few times now. Adam and Israel and so on. I think we have to say that when Jesus comes along, he fulfills all of the roles of those men who went before him, but I think he fulfills them like nobody else ever could, because he is able to fulfill their sonship in a way which nobody else ever could. So think about it, think what I'm saying here. So Adam, as the Son of God, represents God to a certain extent because he has God's image. But Jesus can fulfill that role and represent God uniquely and especially because he is the image of God. That's what Colossians tells us. Israel, as God's son, is called to obey God perfectly. But Jesus, as the son, can obey God perfectly because he is without sin. It's beyond his nature to sin. David, as the Son of God, can rule on God's behalf and express his perfect rule over the creation. But Jesus, as the Son of God, can perfectly express God's rule because he is God over the creation. So he fulfills all of those roles in a way that nobody else ever could. So, that's my first answer to my first question. What makes Jesus a unique Son of God? Jesus is God. I can put it as simply as that. It sounds like a Sunday school answer. I've known that since I was 4 years old. But it's true, and we shouldn't be awkward about it. We shouldn't be embarrassed to put it in bold terms. Jesus is God. Which brings me on to my second question. I think a slightly briefer one. And it's this. How important is it for us to believe this? How important is it for us to believe this? And I'm saying this because it brings us back to that situation I set out at the beginning with the Jehovah's Witnesses. You know, when the Jehovah's Witness knocks at your door and comes there to speak to you about the Bible and offers you a Bible study, what do you make of their spiritual condition? Are they a believer? Are they going to heaven? I mean, yes, we say we believe that Jesus is the Son of God, and we might have good reasons for it in Scripture, but is it essential to salvation? That's the question I'm asking. I mean, there's the Jehovah's Witness at your doorstep, and maybe part of you just wants to say, well, look, I can see your passion. I appreciate you clearly think this is serious, the Bible. And let's just agree to disagree on this one particular point of doctrine. Isn't this something that well-meaning Christians can agree to disagree about? Well, this evening I want to say no. This isn't something that well-meaning Christians can agree to disagree about. But surely you say, salvation isn't about believing in abstract technical doctrine, is it? No, salvation is simple childlike faith in Jesus Christ. And can't a Jehovah's Witness, for all of their doctrinal confusion, at least possess that simple childlike faith in Jesus Christ? Okay, so the Jehovah's Witness says, well, I don't worship Jesus, I don't call him God, but I still love him, I still honour him, I still follow his teachings, I still trust in him. To which I say, I don't believe you. I don't believe you. And I'm being serious. I don't believe that you do love and trust this man insofar as you are not prepared to bow your knee and make him your everything. How important is it for us to believe that Jesus is the Son of God? Crucially important. Absolutely important. Let me spend just a few moments trying to spell this out for us from the Scriptures. Because we said already that John's Gospel emerges on this theme. I would go a step further than that, and I would say that in John's Gospel, belief in Jesus as the only Son of God is the central purpose of this book. Think of it like this. In the first half of John's Gospel, John records several miracles, and six of those miracles he gives a special name to. He calls the miracles signs. The turning of the water into wine, the healing of an official's son, the feeding of the 5,000, the healing of a man on the Sabbath, the healing of a blind man, and the rising of Lazarus. Now, John describes all of those six miracles as signs, and it's important that you realise that a sign is not just another word for a miracle. It's not just that John thinks, well, what word should I use to change it up a bit? No, a sign is a definite thing. A sign is a signification. That is, they signify something. They communicate, they convey information to you. That's what a sign does. And more than that, for John, they invite a response of you. So what do these six signs signify? What response do they invite? Well, John gives us an answer to that question, and he gives it very clearly in chapter 20, which is where we read from. Chapter 20, verses 30 to 31. Let me just read it again. Now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book, but these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. arguably that is the most important statement in this book. And here's what he's saying. He's saying that he has written this gospel to confront us with signs. Signs of what? Well, signs which should move us to believe that Jesus is the Son of God. That's what he says. That's why I think when Jesus turns water into wine, at the very beginning, we read this little note at the back at the beginning of this gospel. This, the first of his signs, John says, Jesus did at Cana in Galilee, and, what we do, manifested his glory. And surely that's the glory of the only Son from the Father, isn't it? Chapter 1, verse 14. And his disciples, how did they respond? Believed on him. Believed on him, presumably as the only Son of God. And moreover, John tells us here in chapter 20 that it's only by believing that Jesus is this Son of God that we can have life in his name. These are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. So here's the point. Belief that Jesus is the only Son of God, God the Son, isn't some secondary issue for John. It's the heart of true Christian belief. There is no life in you if you do not have it. And for that reason, it's no coincidence that we find ourselves now departing from basically every other cult and sect and world religion here. Jehovah's Witnesses, as we say, do not worship Jesus as God. The Quran insists that God has no son. Judaism, as it stands, totally rejects the claims of Jesus. Right from the beginning, why are the Jews seeking to kill him? John 5, verse 18. Because not only was he breaking the Sabbath, but he was even calling God his own Father, making himself equal with God. The Jews got it, but they didn't like it. And this doctrine, then, which I'm teaching today, always has been deeply offensive, but that's because it is the dividing line between true Christianity and false Christianity. It is crucial. A person might claim to be a follower of Jesus, but if Jesus is not, for that person, the only Son of God, they have not grasped the most fundamental and basic thing about him. Now, you might say, Mike, you, and it would be a reasonable question, I suppose, what about the little child? What about the Old Testament believer? What about the handicapped person? Am I barring all of these people from the kingdom? Well, absolutely not. I'm not doing that. I'm not saying that you have to understand, comprehend intelligently, in a detailed way, the divine nature of Christ. I'm not saying you need a PhD in theology to understand this. But I am saying this, I am saying that when any true believer encounters the person of Christ, the instinct of that person's heart is to bow down and surrender themselves without qualification. You do not love him at all until you love him as God. You do not trust him at all until you trust him as God. You do not honour him at all until you honour him as God. And you do not have life at all until you believe that this man is the only Son of God, because that is just what John says. It's only by believing this about Jesus and honouring him as God that you can give him the full allegiance that he demands of you. I'm coming to a finish now, but you know, there are, so there were six signs in the first part of John's Gospel. Well, in the second half of John's Gospel, many would argue that we encounter our seventh and final sign that John wants to record. And it's the resurrection. And here's an interesting thing. Just before those words that we've just read, verses 30 to 31, just before we read those words here in this Gospel, which is really the purpose statement of this whole book, just before those words, we witness a man coming to believe in that seventh final sign. John chapter 20, verse 27,
And
then Jesus said to Thomas, put your finger here and see my hands, and put out your hand and place it in my side. Do not disbelieve, but believe, Thomas. Believe the final sign. Believe sign number 7. Well, Thomas believes. He believes, doesn't he? He's seen the resurrection and he believes in it. And he's blessed for it. But here's the thing which I'm trying to draw attention to here. What precisely does Thomas now believe? Well, the answer comes in verse 28, doesn't it? Thomas answered him, my Lord and my God. Thomas believes that Jesus is the Son of God, is indeed God himself. And he falls at his feet and worships him. And you see what kind of belief this is then. This is not a cold, technical, abstract kind of belief. Thomas isn't making some rational statement of theology here. No, Thomas's belief in the doctrine of Christ's divine sonship is a hearty belief. It's a worshipful belief. It's an adoring belief. It's a self-denying belief which begins now to take over his whole life, maybe for the first time. And so I want to close by saying, if we're going to come down hard on this, this isn't just a case of saying, no, sorry Jehovah's Witnesses, you're not part of us. Sorry Mormons, Muslims, you're not part of us. The gates of heaven are closed to you. No, it's not just about that. It's about being those sort of people who can fully and heartily embrace this doctrine ourselves. Jesus, as I said before, is God. He is our God, and we shouldn't be squeamish or tempted about that. Let us be those who are not ashamed to worship Jesus Christ, the Son of God, Jesus of Nazareth of all people, that Middle Eastern man who roamed the streets of the Middle East 2,000 years ago, the man who ended his earthly ministry there on that cross with the nails through his hands as a crucified criminal looking like an absolute clown being mocked and spat at. And we point to that man and we say, he is our God. And we bow down on our knees and worship him. And that is what true Christian belief is. That is the life which the gospel offers us. Let's be those who do that. And the more we do that, the more we will enter into this fullness of eternal life which only he can provide. Amen.